agenda, so maybe we can all get out on this nice evening. So welcome and thanks for all being here. And did everybody get a chance to review the minutes from our April meeting? And if so, is there a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. So moved. And we're going to have some new people here that we're going to introduce, and then we'll do our general introductions. And so Roxanne's going to introduce Marissa.
Yes, Marissa Armstrong. I'm going to say hi. Some of you have known her as Marissa Harshman. She joined us as our new PIO/communications specialist on April 30th. And Don Strick retired. And Marissa said that if he ever retired, this would be her dream job. And now she now is having second thoughts after this.
A nightmare.
Be careful what you wish for. That's all I know. But we are really pleased to have her here. And Marissa was with the Columbian for 7 years, correct?
Almost nine years,
my goodness. And she reported on public health and health issues and nutrition and all that. So I'm sure you've seen a lot of her writing over the years. And then prior to that, you were with Douglas County?
Yeah. Public News Review.
There you go. Okay. And she has a degree in journalism and political science. So she absolutely has a great career. So we want to welcome her. And we'll be going around and doing some more introductions.
Roxanne, didn't we hire her so she'd stop writing about us?
She used to write about why she
Booked you. Yeah, we didn't
even enjoy that, right? That's what I thought, yeah. Yeah. You were always pretty nice to us. So. It's good to see you.
Yes, she'll definitely keep us on our toes and keep us honest. Anyway, welcome.
And we're excited for our new tribal member. You go by Cassie? Okay, so this is Cassie, and I think Alan's going to introduce.
Yeah, I'm really delighted and honored. We received a real strong recommendation from Steve Kutz, who's the Director of Health and Human Services for the Pallets Indian Tribe, recommending Cassie for her position on FAC. I'm not going to go, her resume is pretty impressive, but I just want to mention a couple of things. First, Cassie is a neurotrauma intensive care nurse, so she's got a clinical background. And she's also served in several leadership positions. Cassie, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've been chairperson of the Cowlitz Indian Health Board, and you've been the Cowlitz Tribe Delegate to the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, and currently you're an elected member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribal Council. And did I get all that correct?
Yes, sir.
So she really great experience in both at the policy level and in working in nursing. So I think she's going to be a great addition to FAC. And she goes by Cassie. I don't know if you want to say a few words or.
No, I can. I live in Battleground, Washington. I have three children who are a priority. I graduated nursing in 97. I worked in Eastern Washington and then moved over here, and I've been at Emanuel ever since. I started in the emergency room. I still work in the emergency room as a trauma response nurse, and then I work in the neurotrauma ICU. I came back here in 2001. My mom volunteered me for the health board at the tribe, and I have a daughter and she's a nurse, and so I started there, and we helped open up the clinic that we have in Longview, and it's grown. We have clinical services in Vancouver and now Tukwila. I sit on two national committees, the Tribal Leaders Diabetes Committee and also the NTAC, which is the National Tribal Advisory Committee on Behavioral Health. And I was on the Mental Health Advisory Board here in Clark County for about 8 years, and so other than that,
your free time has zero. So.
I do a lot of cultural activities, and I'm really involved culturally in the tribe, so don't let my light skin fool you.
Okay, great. Do we want to just go around? I can start, and we can do our introductions. I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I am a veterinarian practicing in Clark County. I'm board chair. Lydia, you get to go.
Lydia Gurman, admin assistant with public health.
David Scott, I'm with the city of Washougal, city administrator, and I am, it's a long thing to say, the non-elected rep of Clark County cities and towns other than Vancouver. I'm not going to tease Joan this time.
Marissa.
Jan Scott, I'm the environmental public health director. Sandy Brown, I represent consumers, but I'm retired from WSU Extension.
Jeff Harbison, I'm the administrative services director.
Hi, I'm Joan Kayley. I'm a nurse, but I sit on this council as the non-elected representative from the city of Vancouver.
And I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm the director of community health and safety.
I'm Marla Sainer. I'm a nurse also, and I have worked at Peace Health at Southwest here for the last several years, and then recently retired, and there was an opening for a consumer of public health service, so I was able to stay on the council. Thanks to meet you.
Hey guys, so I'm Larry Neville. I practice neurology up in Longview, and I serve as CMO at Southwest. He's also.
Does everybody know what CMO is?
Chief Medical Officer.
Alan Melnick, I'm the public health director and the county health officer.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Jill Cromwell, I'm with Solid Waste Education and Outreach. I'm not on the committee. I'm just here for tonight.
I'm Steve Becker. I'm the executive director of Vancouver's Downtown Association, and I'm here as a consumer of public health services. Scott Johnson, I'm the emergency manager for CRESA, and I represent my director when his daughter comes into town late and he tells me at 12 o'clock that I'm going to the public health.
Well, welcome aboard. It's good to have you. I'm Remy Eason. I represent the Dental Society here in the county.
My name is John Roth, water quality specialist for Clark Public Utilities and represent public water systems in Clark County.
I'm Arlen Zerthy. I'm a psychiatrist at the Vancouver Clinic, and I'm representing medical doctors in Clark County.
Okay, and then we have Quentin. He's here from, do you have any comments or public? All right, moving right along. So we've got our department updates. Thank you for coming, Jill, and I think you're up.
So my name is Jill. I'm with the Solid Waste Education Outreach Green Neighbors Program, which is basically residential recycling and waste reduction and prevention outreach to the public. I'm here to talk about the Recycle Arts Festival today. How many people have been to the festival? Downtown Vancouver?
Have you guys? The very best festival in the world.
Have you guys heard of it? The ones down there?
Wasn't last year super, super hot? Wasn't it like that crazy hot?
So last year was hot, yeah. Yeah. There's been a couple years where there's been rain and wind. But it's usually warm, it's usually nice. So this is the 13th year of the festival. I'm going to pass these around for you guys. And you can take some, pass them around, you can hand them out to other people. So basically, the Recycled Arts Festival is held the last weekend in June every year, Saturday and Sunday at Esther Shore Park downtown. It brings about 35, they're guessing 35 to 40,000 people that weekend, which is the largest event in Vancouver. We have usually over 130 recycled art vendors, anything from recycled or upcycled or reclaimed upcycled products like wood, glass, to things like recycled Starbucks gift cards. And people make jewelry out of them. It's really cool. A lot of like huge range, huge variety. A lot of metalwork. We have a sculpture garden, and artists place their items there, and then participants vote for them. The person who wins gets a free booth the next year. Here's some recycled bottle art. These are faucets. It's a faucet tree. We also have roaming entertainers, stilt walkers, jugglers, magicians, and children's crafts and events. We have live music on stage both Saturday and Sunday. This year on Sunday, we're having our very own Recycle Man, which is Pete Dubois, and he'll be performing 9:30 Saturday morning. Following him will be Portland Taiko, which is a Japanese drumming band in Portland. and that leads right up to the procession of the species, which is a parade at 11 o'clock. So Sunday will be very energetic and a lot of fun. If you have one day to come down, I'd suggest that morning, especially if you have kids and you want to have the day to watch. So the festival started as a way to inspire and educate the community about waste reduction. Not only recycling, but reusing and not using our natural resources. We have a booth at the festival for our green programs, which is the Green Neighbors Program, the Master Composter Recycler Program, which is Pete, Green Schools, which is Michelle Kucinich, and Green Business, which is Sarah Kearns. We have a few MCR volunteers that staff the booth, as well as our staff. And this is a way to directly interact with the public. They can ask questions, we can educate, and we can really engage them. We rely heavily on volunteers. We have between 100 and 150 volunteers that work at that festival. So we really appreciate them. We have a t-shirt that we give out to all the volunteers to identify them, and then they can take home a souvenir. So this is also an opportunity for nonprofits to have a booth there. We have Habitat for Humanity, Stream Team, Urban Forestry, Friends of Trees. This year we'll have a Repair Cafe there, and Tossed and Found, which Waste Connections runs. And this booth is actually items from the landfill that were gleaned, and they were all reusable. They're all, you know, they weren't damaged or anything. It was all things that you could sell. You know, kind of like Goodwill stuff, but it's still stuff that didn't need to go to garbage. There was one year, Sally told me the story, that they gave out tickets to people for an item here, randomly. I'm not telling the story very well. So like, randomly people got these tickets where they could get an item. So they gave them out and there was a mad rush, kind of like Walmart at Christmas time. And people were actually like injured.
It's like a Black Friday. My mother-in-law at 4 o'clock in the morning.
So they stopped.
That was me. I don't know. But they get crazy.
So I mentioned really quickly the procession of the species, which was new last year, and it was a parade to celebrate the art, the community, and our natural world. It actually started in Olympia, Washington, as the reenactment of the Endangered Species Act, I think, which was like 24 years ago, something like that. And it was in, it was along with their annual spring art walk and Earth Day. So a lot of cities and organizations have adopted this as part of Earth Day, and so Sally actually brought this last year to the parade, because it kind of, it goes along with, you know, reusing, sustainability, and also the art part as far as creating your own costumes. We had workshops where we made masks, and we had this Maracatu band, which is like a Brazilian band. It was really fun. They're back this year. We had two unicorns in the parade. And then, so one thing, there's a couple of new things this year. Repair Cafe, like I mentioned, will be there. They'll have a demonstration booth where they'll show how to repair items. I think it'll be mostly simple things like sharpening tools and nothing too advanced like they do at their actual events. But it's a way to kind of see what they do and get an idea. But you can bring garden tools. We'll be promoting that. People can bring down a tool and have it repaired for free. And then the other thing that is new is the Falconer. And this organization educates the public about raptor conservation, reducing pesticides, chemicals in your garden, reducing littering and poisons, and using lead for hunting and stuff like that. So they'll have live birds of prey. They'll have some owls, probably vultures, and probably, I think this is a stinker falcon, some kind of deer falcon. And so they'll be having some displays with the live birds and talking a lot about just how we can conserve our habitats for wildlife. So I went through that really fast. So that's Saturday, June 23rd, and Sunday, June 24th, which is the festival this year. The parade is Sunday at 11.
Is there going to be any workshops this year for
costumes? We actually have Chris Potter, who is a teacher, who will be organizing those. She has a couple lined up right now, but they haven't gotten the dates exact. Once those are set up, we'll send out a news release, and we'll start promoting it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so we're hoping to have at least 5 workshops.
And I have to tell you, I bought a birdhouse from one of the vendors 2 years ago, and every year I've had birds that have moved into it, and this year I have another crop of, I'm not sure what they are, but they're very noisy. They love the house. So anyway, it's great to see that. And the vendor that actually sold it loves to have pictures of birds actually using her house. So I was out there sort of trying to stealthy get this picture of the bird. I finally got an action shot of the bird. So
oh, nice.
I should, my pictures will hopefully be on her
website. That's exciting. A lot of it is much functional art, you know.
Yeah,
it's cool. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I went to this festival, it's the kind of thing you go to and you just think, oh my goodness, how creative people are, and then to realize that people are making these incredible items out of recycled things. It's just like, I know I had some Starbucks cards I gave to the woman who made the Starbucks jewelry.
Nice. Yeah.
And I have a gold Starbucks card, and she wants the gold cards, and I'm not ready to give up my But it's free. You know, it's just wonderful.
Exactly, yeah.
And the metal outdoor, I treat myself every year to getting an outdoor metal sculpture. So I've got a centipede and a flying pig and a turtle. I mean, just, you know, from the metal sculpture made out of all the recycled metalwork is fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great to hear. I mean, the wow factor, you know, people being like, I can't believe that you can make this from that is really what point of the festival is that we can actually reuse things and make new things.
Do you need any more volunteers? Are you good on
that? We actually we're still looking for volunteers. We have a signup.com, I don't know what it's called, sign up sheet online
on the website.
So if you go to our recycledartsfestival.com, from there you can click on volunteer and that'll take you to that site. So if anyone wants to volunteer, you get a t-shirt and you get a free lunch. Well, that's another thing. We have food carts. This year we're going to have, I think, Fixins, which is like a Creole, Cajun type food, and a Vietnamese food truck with banh mi's, and then hopefully Mighty Bowl because they just got their truck going again. Yeah, and then ice cream. So that's it for Recycled Arts Festival. I do have a couple other events. Which is kind of interesting. We hold author talks at Vintage Books, and we bring in kind of interesting and unique authors to talk about different subjects related to waste reduction, prevention, sustainability in general. So the next one is the Green Burial Guidebook, and it's about how you can have a more environmentally friendly burial. So it's taking that to the next level. But the author is actually called the Green Reaper, and it'll be an interesting talk. I think I kind of started reading a little bit, but it kind of opens your eyes to what just the embalming fluid and those crazy caskets are not only really expensive, they're just really bad for the environment. And then July 15th, we have the Natural Garden Tour, which is our annual tour of residential gardens, and it really showcases what real people do in their home, and you can kind of see that it's possible to have a natural garden at home, whether it's a small one or some people have a couple acres and they're incredible, but there's also smaller urban plots that have amazing gardens without the use of chemicals or pesticides.
So. And the Green Neighbors webpage, what is that again, greenneighbors.org?
Yeah, it's Clark, clarkgreenneighbors.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
One word, right?
Yep, all one word. And you can actually get there from the clark.wa.gov site too. If you go to Solid
from
Waste.
Can you get it from our department?
From public health, I think. I think it goes to public health and then Solid Waste goes to Clark Green Neighbors, and then we all have our individual websites.
Okay.
Any questions? No?
comments?
Sounds fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jill.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. I do have more of these if anybody wants to take some and hand them out.
Okay.
All right.
I'll probably volunteer.
All right.
Yeah, thank you. All right, Jeff. You're on to budget. We're on to budget.
All righty, that was quick. So the budget process is in full swing. A few of us meet on Thursday to discuss our situation with environmental public health fees and receive some additional guidance on Thursday. All decision packages, which are basically any adjustments that we're going to ask for, are due by May 31st for me. I'm out of town after that. We have a balanced budget that we're actually proposing. We're not, at the moment, we're not being asked to make any cuts, reductions. We're asking for a fairly significant fee increase for our EH programs, environmental health programs. Based on Clark County guidance, though, the counselor's guidance and budget office guidance. It's a very compressed process this year. Normally, everything's due at the end of July. It's due early June this time, so it's about 2 months of time I've lost. It's also a very manual process. There's no budget system. We're using Excel spreadsheets for everything. So it's very time consuming. But like I said, we are right now we have a balanced budget with no cuts to staff, which is a good sign. So the county is facing about a $12 million budget deficit in the general fund. So there will be some budget interventions. They've not all been put forward yet to staff, managers, directors. So we're not exactly sure where we'll land, but like I said, right now we have a balanced budget and we're fairly happy with that. So.
If at some point we would like staff to rally or provide some support, what's the timeline on that?
So there will be two opportunities in the November Board of Health meeting. That should be when our environmental public health fees will be heard in ordinance form. So it's when we bring forward fee adjustments. That will be heard at the November Board of Health meeting. And then December 4th, which is the first Tuesday of December, Clark County Council will have a public hearing on the actual budget, the 2019-20 budget itself. So if we need FAC support at either of those events, those will be the two times we'll definitely, those would be the two dates. The November Board of Health and then that December 4th budget adoption hearing. Excellent question, Janice.
Is it possible that we might, before that, like need a letter or anything?
We're going to have an environmental public health fee work session at some point, I assume. It's not dead set that that will happen. I'm assuming that will happen. We might need a letter of support around that time, or at least prior to the Board of Health hearing, I would think. This, like I said, there's a lot of moving parts. They're trying to implement clarity-based budgeting, working on the new environmental, a new accounting system called Workday. There's a lot of things moving all at once. Again, there's no budget system. We're using Excel spreadsheets, so a lot of moving parts. So yes, there's potential of asking the FAC to write a letter of support for either our budget or for our fee schedule or some other aspect of our budget, and then possible testimony at either Board of Health or the Clark County Council hearing in December.
Where are we with the fees in terms of our technical advisory groups? I mean, are they moving forward?
Tomorrow, actually, we present our fees to the on-site septic TAC. We presented them already to SPAC, is that right?
The food TAC.
The food TAC has seen a little bit of, we'll be bringing them to the solid waste SWAC, their advisory committee. I think more than likely after the meeting this week, hopefully we'll have some pretty good guidance in the board. But I did one-on-one with all five county councilors and did not get clear guidance. So it's been a difficult process. It's not what I'm used to. not having a permanent county manager probably plays a part. There's a lot of things in play right now.
Are you guys going to update your budget system the way that you guys do your budget so it's not so labor intensive?
Yeah, the budget office, excellent question.
You don't probably have the answer.
No. The budget office is looking at software packages.
Yeah, that seems kind of archaic. I mean, just from what you're saying. You would have to agree.
Yeah. I use Excel files internally for our internal budget. But that's much more than the entire county budget.
The whole county just uses Excel spreadsheets for their budget?
Yes, the last budget and this current budget, both. We used to use Oracle FMS for our accounting system, and the budget module is pretty not very good. I was able to function in it okay, but others struggled to a point where they just stopped using it, and we just started doing manual processes with Excel. I believe the software they're looking at for the next budget is called Questica. There's actually a conversation going on right now about the county moving to an annual budget process. When you buy new budget software, they all come loaded. They're built to do annual budgeting. So having to have them reprogrammed, redesigned, and do biannual actually costs you money. So there's a push to, we need to basically decide now if we do annual or stay with our process that we have now. It seemed like the annual budget proposal was going to move forward pretty easily. I went to a meeting with finance managers last week. There was significant pushback from some of my peers, not from me. I understand the pushback. I also see pros and cons of doing annual and biannual budgeting. So I can adapt. I've got great staff working for me. So we can make everything work.
And one of those, that budgeting, what's the expense of buying something like that?
What would it cost?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a very broad range, depending on how much customizing you need done. It's not cheap, it's several hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah.
I think with the configuration of professional services, I'm at an approaching like $1.5 million. I think I can't be certain that sounds like the number I heard.
I guess it depends on how much money you allocate to the time that it takes you guys to do the budget. I don't know the answer.
There's a couple of departments that talked about if they want to annual budget, they're going to need to add finance staff to assist in the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily know if that's the 100% truth. It is more work. When you're not doing the annual budget, when you're not off year, you're doing budget adjustments. And those adjustment processes might take me a couple of days. And the biannual budget takes me several weeks, so it is more work. But again, there are those pros. Like we would bring fees forward every year versus every 2 years, so they're smaller fee adjustments. It's not as large of a hit. You know,
mm-hmm.
I do think I agree with the budget office. They're talking about people do a better job looking at their forecast of expenses and revenues doing an annual budget. They don't right now. They have so many opportunities to adjust the budget, but they don't need to be perfect. They don't need to try as hard. I don't do that. I'm always trying to be as finite, as fine as I possibly can, which probably adds more stress to me, but this is how I operate. So anyway, there's a very large general fund deficit. So far, we have not been told to identify any potential cuts. We're not asking for any additional general fund support, which they're happy with.
Do you know, Jeff, when they might be letting people or departments know what the cuts are going to be?
So the decision packages are all due June 8th, again, I'm gone, but between that date and mid-August, August 10th is when revised adjustment packages are due. My assumption is that the revision to those adjustment packages will be based on that guidance.
Okay.
If you ask for a certain number of things and they say that's not going to happen, you need to take something out of there, then you would revise those packages. I also believe that if there are directives for cuts, those packages that are due August 10th, those would fall under that grouping as well.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I've been through so many budgets here. We've had $6 million deficits just here in health. I mean, I've seen it much worse than where we're at now. We've obviously transitioned programs to the community. Our entire clinical programs, our WIC program is no longer with us. So I've been through many more difficult budgets than where we're at now. However, there still could be information coming down the pipeline that we haven't been told that could make this a difficult budget process as well. So the more difficult it is, the more support we will need from that, I'm sure. And you guys have played a vital role in our budgets in the past, for sure. Any other budget questions or fee questions or anything else?
Thanks, Jeff. So Dr. Melnick is going to talk about mental health sales tax RFP for NFP.
Well, okay. I'll try to make this brief. So back in 2005, the Washington State Legislature passed a statute that authorized counties to impose a 1/10 of 1% sales and use tax to address individuals with substance use disorder, mental health conditions, and so it enabled counties to impose this. Clark County passed the countywide 1/10 of 1% sales tax in 2007. And all funding must follow the criteria outlined in statute. I won't read the number of it, but it needs to be used for substance use and mental health treatment services or therapeutic courts, and actually it can be used for prevention as well. Senator Hargrave had written a letter indicating, and that's on record, that the intent of the statute was for the entire continuum of care, both prevention as well as treatment. Right now, given what the revenues have been and what the expenses have been over the years, the projected available fund balance, so what's sitting in the fund as for 2019 to 2020, is about $8.1 million. And there needs to be some sort of fund balance in case, sales tax is pretty volatile, can go up and down pretty easily. So you need to have some sort of balance in there in case the economy goes sour. But right now, given the $8.1 million that's in there, there's $4.7 million available for ongoing requests, as well as $3.4 million available for one-time requests in terms of the, so there's some funding available. So the county is going to issue an RFP, and it's going to go out sometime, and the dates are changing a little bit as we're working on it. The RFP is going to go out sometime this month. It's going to be finalized this month. It's going to go out later in the month once it's agreed upon. And then the deadline, theoretically, would be sometime in June. They'll be reviewed from June through July. And then recommendations, there's an advisory board group that I'm on, as well as a number of other people, including two county counselors, will do the scoring and make recommendations probably towards the end of July. And this will be presented to the county manager sometime later in July. The idea of this is to have the recommendations in terms of what program should be funded in time for the counselors to vote on the to pass the budget for 2019-20. The eligible, given that prevention as well as treatment programs are eligible for funding, we're going to submit a proposal for funding the Nurse Family Partnership for 2019-20. So that would be to be able to keep it going. It would be for the 2 years. It would be a little bit over $800,000. So have that.
Yep.
We might submit a second piece to fund. And Roxanne, correct me if I'm wrong about this. An add-on, actually a supplement to the Nurse Family Partnership that would involve having community health workers support the work that the nurses are doing and basically helping with their clients. And the nurses would be doing what the nurses do in the Nurse Family Partnership model, but the community health workers would help provide support around social determinants of health, including things like housing. And Roxanne, you can, mm-hmm. I'm saying anything incorrectly. So we'll submit, we'll probably submit, that would be an additional 400,000 over the 2 years. So our total ask might be around $1.2 million, which we think is reasonable considering not only is the Nurse Family Partnership shown in years of clinical trials to provide prevention in terms of substance use disorder and mental health, but a lot of the clients, the families that the nurses are seeing are living with substance use and mental health issues as well. So it meets the requirements of the RFP. And just from speaking to our Board of Health and our county counselors who ultimately will decide on this, there is support in not only with our counselors as well in the community for the NFP. As you know, East Health Southwest has provided $300,000 in funding over 3 years. So there's a lot of support in the community, and I'm optimistic that we'll be successful with this. We definitely need the funding. Jeff talked about the budget. Without this funding, we'd have to stop doing the Nurse Family Partnership. So
yeah, our balanced budget assumes that $800,000 of mental health sales tax support for that NFP program. So
I don't know if you, Janice, Roxanne, and Jeff, do you have anything to add? What I just said.
I think the additional funding that we're looking for the community health worker part of the program, both is something that I think Peace Health Southwest was interested in looking at as well as a potential model. And we've also engaged the NFP Home Office, and they are also Dr. Olds, and they are also interested in developing this kind of a model. You have to have strict fidelity to the model that NFP has developed. However, they are looking at ways of being able to allow the nurse to do what the nurse does best, and that's not necessarily on the phone, scheduling, transportation or appointments or whatever. So that's the idea, is to really pull in some additional support around the nurse so that we can not only see more clients, but then also make sure that the nurse and the family have additional support for them to access all kinds of different types of services. So we're very excited about this and hoping that it will.
And I don't think there's a mechanism for letters of support, because I was looking at the application. If there is, we'll ask. But I haven't seen that.
I think that's really exciting. I mean, you think back when the Nurse Family Partnership started back in 1977, things were way different in terms of nursing practice. And so, to me, that's the fact that Dr. Olds and the NFP office is interested in the community health worker, to me, is a, really a positive thing, because we're in the world now, and nurses aren't doing what they did in 1977.
They're looking and supporting enhancements to the model. We're not trying to change the model. This is an enhancement to the model. The other thing that we're doing, you probably know about, we're already part of a pilot. The Nurse Family Partnership was developed for first-time pregnant moms, but we're working with Dr. Olds and his team and several other sites around looking at providing services to moms having subsequent children as well. And we're actually doing that in Calhoun County as well. So we've got a shared services agreement with Calhoun County. We're providing Nurse Family Partnership services there as well.
And one of the things that we found is we've engaged in this pilot project with moms that have other kids in other children in the family, is that there's a significant amount of need for those other children. And even though those other children are not necessarily part of the NFP program, the NFP nurse is actually focusing on the mom and the new baby. There's a lot of services that the whole family needs, and that's where the community health worker fees will really, really aid. The other thing that they've recently done is they've enhanced it with telemeetings, basically, is what they're calling them. So once the nurse establishes a rapport with the client, there are opportunities. Sometimes moms can't make it in, or families can't make it in, or it's not convenient for them to have the nurse out to wherever it is that they're living or staying. And so these televisits are another option to make sure that they continue to get those services. So in some cases, our nurses are also engaging in telemedicine and these televisits with their clients, and that's actually worked out really well too.
It's interesting, you know, the NFP model goes back to the 70s, but now, you know, in the late 90s, we began to learn about ACEs and ACEs prevention. It's a great ACEs prevention model, and if it were successful in the RFP, I think it makes a statement that this type of program, the Nurse Family Partnership, is a worthy recipient of mental health sales tax funding. It actually not only provides support for moms who might have substance use disorder or mental health issues, but it also is primary prevention for the babies. It helps prevent substance use disorder, mental health issues with those children as they get older. So we're pretty optimistic that it's going to work. No, that was you. Any questions about it?
I think you're still on for TB updates.
Yeah, we go from mental health sales tax to tuberculosis. So I'll be brief about this one. So you may have heard on the news, we did get a press release out, and we got a provider advisory out, as well as letters to parents. We've had a TB case, a case of active contagious TB at one of the, I'm losing the name of the school.
Skyview.
Thank you. Skyview High School. And this case was at the school while they may have been contagious from July 1st of 2017 to May 1st of 2018. So TB is, you know, slow growing, kind of indolent, and you can go months without it, in some cases without it being recognized. So we've been doing an investigation. It's hard to get TB. It's not like measles or flu that are contagious. You do need to spend time in an enclosed area, a significant amount of time with somebody who's coughing the bug up. But for being careful about this, we're identifying close contacts of this person, both, you know, friends, family, as well as people in the school, and maybe workplaces, and we're going to be identifying people that they may have had close contact with and having them come in for evaluation to see if they become infected, and then evaluate them based on that. Where it looks like in the school itself, we got the letter out to parents yesterday, and we will be notifying staff who might have been exposed as well. In terms of students who need to be tested, I think we're around 300. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly good size investigation. There'll be more people that we're going to notify as well, depending on where the case was. I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see many more than, I think it'd be unlikely even if we see a few folks who've become infected, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility. So those people will be evaluated. If they have what most people would have once they get infected is latent TB, where the bug is in them but not doing anything, they'll be treated to prevent them from getting active disease. And then anybody who's got active disease will be evaluated for treatment. And of course, if we have more cases of active disease, we would have to, and if they were pulmonary and coughing it up, we'd have to notify their contacts as well. But I think that's unlikely, but it's not impossible. So we're still at the fairly early stage, since we're gonna be testing people this month. Later this month, we're going to have 2 days. We're going to set up a clinic, a pod. Well, it's not really a point of dispensing, but it's like that. We'll be doing testing, I believe, at the school. Is that correct, Roxanne?
Correct, yes.
And then because of last exposure, by the way, this person is not at the school. Once the case was diagnosed and evaluated, they were no longer at the school. So they haven't been there since May 1st. But since it can take up to 2 months for your test to become positive, we're going to do two rounds of testing, one now in May, and another round of testing after July 1st, around July 1st, which would be about 2 months after the last possible exposure. It's actually 8 weeks.
What test?
A little bit before July 1st.
Do you run this, like, intradermal skin?
We're probably not going to do many skin tests. We're probably going to mostly do, there's a blood test called QFT, QuantiFERON. We'll be doing the blood test for the most part. It just, in terms of kids coming and coming back, and with a skin test, you have to do it, you know, you have to read it in 2 or 3 days. With a blood test, you just do the blood test, and you don't have to have them come back.
So if it's negative, so it'll be a negative. What kind of a test is it?
We're going to be doing the blood test.
Oh, yeah. So. What is it? Just a quick snap test, or like how does it?
Yeah, it goes to the lab, and you get the results basically
immediately.
If it's positive, that's an indication that you're infected. It's called QuantiFERON Gold. Anyway, I don't know if that answers your. It's a numerical figure you get mm-hmm. on the, as opposed to the size of the skin in duration.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more. I can get into details. The one problem with the skin test is if you're from a part of the world where they've given you BCG, which is an injection, is a treatment given to kids to prevent them from developing invasive TB, which is common in other parts of the world. That can affect your skin test later on. It does not affect the blood test. So that's another advantage. The disadvantage of the blood test is it's more expensive. Okay. When you think about having people come back a second time in the nursing time to read the test after they come back, the price differential isn't so great.
How long do we know how the student
we haven't said whether it's a student or a staff member. Notice that I did not say that.
They are not there any longer. That's all I could get.
They are not there any longer. We just, given that there aren't that many cases of TB, we wanted to make, and given the stigma that's associated with TB, we wanted to make it as difficult as possible for anybody to figure out who this person might be. But what was your question? How are they doing? They're doing fine. Yeah, they're doing.
They're not there because they have deceased. They're not deceased. They're not no longer being mentioned because they've died. They are no longer being mentioned because they're somewhere else.
There's been some. There are some. I can't really talk about the specifics in terms of how they're doing with their treatment. And so, but it's a curable condition. So
I believe the question was.
Yeah. How do they get it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the origin of TB is being exposed to somebody somewhere in your lifetime who is coughing it up.
Have they figured out where they were in order to...
Telling you exactly where they were, maybe giving you additional information about this person. So
so yes, but that's not just being disclosed.
Huh?
You just don't. It's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I was just going to say, Jeff's talking about budgets, and I'm just curious.
I think
what's roughly the cost of an investigation involving 300 high school students for TB?
That's actually going to be more than 300 when we're done, but that's an outstanding question. So this is fits into what we call foundational public health services that we've asked the legislature for funding. And right now, a lot of this is being funded. The money we get from the state does not pay for the cost of doing all of this. And Jeff, I think we're going to do the best job we can trying to capture the amount of time that's spent on this. Is that correct? So we're going to try to quantify it, because I want to be able to use that information not only in advocating with our elected officials here, but this is information that we need to compile for the legislature, because this is basically public safety. Nobody argues about, you know, we need cops on the street, we need to pay them to protect us. But, you know, we need to be able to make a case that, you know, this is protecting the public from tuberculosis, and it is not cheap. So I don't know, Jeff, if you want to say anything much more.
I'll just say it also helps us tell our story during this priority-based budgeting exercise for the counselors about the importance of what we do daily. Each one of the one, I believe, was well over $1 million. That incident command. This won't be that expensive, obviously. This is much smaller. But we will be tracking cost for this incident for sure. I can't even guess right now.
It's an incredible data point, I think.
Just
providing these fundamental services.
You know, you might remember, it's not just TB, you might remember a few years ago we had 120 cases of salmonella at a local restaurant.
Chipotle.
No, that was on the border.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you also found this Chipotle.
That was, Chipotle was E.coli, wasn't it?
Yes. And
we were part of we were the first, and actually in terms of, we were not just protecting Clark County, we were protecting the entire country because the first few cases were found here. Then we were working with our partners across the river, and there were a couple of cases in Multnomah County. We thought it might have been a food handler who moved back and forth. And then there were a few cases in Seattle. Then we realized it was more of a upstream from our local restaurant, and it ended up being cases in other parts of the U.S. But we like to take the credit for here. We in Clark County were actually the forward part of the spear in figuring out
the code.
We broke the code in terms of a nationwide outbreak. So we not only protect this community, we protect we're only protected in the United States. Based on the weakest part of our, local public health system around the country. So it's important to have a strong public health entity everywhere. I'm blabbering too much, I apologize.
Alan, I think this is the kind of story that, as Steve was saying, it makes public health visible, and that's why we need to make a story, because it makes public health visible, because this is the kind of thing that if we didn't talk about it, people would say, well, what are you doing with all that money, it's an opportunity as well to shine a light on how much it really costs to keep our community.
And we'll be giving regular updates to the Board of Health on this.
All of us have lived in other parts of the world, and those of us who've been sick with dysentery in a hospital for 2 weeks, because you ate a popsicle on the street in Bangkok one time.
Boy, you know what you really ate? Really dysentery.
I don't want to know, man. No, he doesn't. I mean,
it's all right. I've had it in travel. Okay. Yeah, no.
It makes public health real. That might be this case does.
And TB is still a major killer around the world, so it's still very common in other countries in the developing world.
Do students in the schools at any point in their educational process get routinely screened for TB like it used to be?
And the reason for that in the U.S. is that TB is so uncommon, it would be really cost prohibitive to be doing that. It wouldn't be a good use of resources at this stage.
When I was doing public health nursing in Anzuli, Alaska,
where
most of the seniors had active TB, it was once or twice a year that I would screen every kid.
You're in a different situation.
Yeah. But that's what made me wonder about this case. I had never heard nothing about it, but it's the wheels are spinning like that. So
and basically giving you guys information on the origin. Well, first of all, I couldn't say for sure exactly where they got it. Just know that TB is out there and it's very common in different parts of the world.
Are you getting a lot of questions from family members? I know when the kids thing comes in and says that somebody has lice in the classroom, I'm like freaking out. But like if someone said, "Oh, your kid has TB," I mean, that what's happening with public health,
with
the media?
I really appreciate having Marissa Armstrong.
Right.
Here,
I mean, you need to calm everybody down.
From her having her here instead of being on the other side, is she made a point that if we got out the press release early and got as much information out to the parents early, that would reduce the amount of questions we got. And I don't think we're getting many questions, are we? Or
I haven't heard. Yeah, no, we really aren't.
I mean, that's amazing, I think, because, I mean, like I said, that's great. I mean, it's really good because
this may change my thinking about a lot of things, because I think the default in public health is to worry about privacy and confidentiality. And not that we shouldn't worry about that, but
we don't care.
Thanks, Janice. But I think there's a balance in terms of getting information out to people and being proactive in terms of getting information out as well. So, anyway.
There was just recently a big salmonella outbreak back east.
With? Associated with?
AIDS.
Oh, yeah, I think I heard about
that. They traced it to a farm in Indiana, but most all of it was down in the South Carolina, Georgia, all that. They had recalled like 200,000 eggs from this, from different grocery stores that carried certain brands of eggs.
Any romaine lettuce updates?
I think that passed through the, I think the last bit of romaine that was associated with that outbreak was out of commerce a while ago. So
it's over, nothing to worry about.
I don't think we have any cases in Clark County?
There's one, it was the one I think in Washington, but it wasn't here.
So there was never any official all clear that I've been able to.
The romaine?
Yeah,
I agree with you. Yeah, I'm not riding romaine.
You're not going to eat romaine now?
Well, no, I will now that you said it's okay. I hadn't come to my meeting yet.
Long enough to have any sitting there, that, and nobody freezes romaine, so we're all good. Yeah. But, I mean, E. coli will survive freezing, so, yes. But you don't do that with romaine, fortunately. Okay. Any other questions about TV? I could go on for hours about TV. I love TV.
That's a good thing.
It's a fascinating disease.
All right, Roxanne, you
can be here. Yeah. So at the last meeting, we let you all know that we had the Public Health Community Board. We had several. We had announced the nominees at the last meeting, and in your packet you have who the winners were. So everyone was an honorable mention, but Jen Weichert got the individual award, and some of you know her. She's the executive director of Bridgeview, and she's worked with Vancouver Housing Authority for many, many years. She's fantastic, and the work that she's doing is fantastic. And I'm not going to read it, but the blurb here captures what Jan is doing in the community, and so she was a very worthy recipient of this award. We had great nominees, and I think it was a difficult process with the committee that went through and took a look at all the nominees. The organization award went to Clark County Food Bank, and they were outstanding. Some of you had the chance to be at the event. But they brought a lot of their volunteers in, and they really highlighted their volunteers at the event. It was really great, because really that's what makes the Clark County Food Bank is a very small staff, and without their volunteers, they really couldn't do the work that they do. So I thought it was great that while the food bank got the award, they were really great about recognizing their volunteers. So anyway, it was a great event. These are great, great candidates, and we really appreciate your support through this and the folks that were involved in the selection committee. So next year it'll be another award ceremony. And then also I wanted to announce, if you're okay, go forward.
Yeah.
Okay. So Joan has received, and I'm going to pull this up. She with the EOCF, which is early. I've got it down here. I was early learning champ. What is EOCF?
Thank you.
I should know that, right? I'm not good at acronyms. Anyway, Joan received the Early Learning Champion Award this year, along with a couple of other recipients. But we wanted to recognize her, too. She's the board chair of not only SELF, which is Support for Early Learning and Families, but also with the ACES Action Alliance. And she's been very much involved in that. And she was recognized for that work, along with all the other work that she does in the community. So I just wanted to say congratulations, and you're well-deserving of that, too.
I wanted to share that part of my, I'm a geral nurse. I'm a gerontological nurse. And why am I involved in early learning? It all started here at this council several years ago when Marnie Story, for those of you that were around, did the presentation on ACEs. And it's like that was, where have I been all those years that I wasn't aware of this? It's sort of this. And then as we begin to look at the issues that we have in our community, homelessness, which I'm involved in housing, et cetera, upstream thinking gets us right back to early learning. And so it's all because of what happened here at the council that I got involved in this world of early learning and adverse childhood experiences. And I wanted to highlight the other people that were honored, because this was really, I was absolutely surprised by didn't know who had nominated me until that day. But Doug Lehrman got the Allen Ham Leadership Award. He was the EOCF Executive Director for many years. And then what EOCF does is they also honor a staff person, which is Lynn Madden, who's a preschool teacher at Innovative. Then an early learning volunteer who's on the Parent Policy Council and ESD 112, and Ms. CAC. And then the early learning community partner is Dr. Catherine Vaughn, a pediatrician at Vancouver Clinic. And then the outstanding early learning professional was Jessica, and if I can say her name, Achilopal, who's an early childhood education teacher at EOCF. And then the outstanding new early learning professional, Rosanna Hunt, who's a teacher family advocate for EOCF. And then the business partner of the year, which is Max Contright, who does emergency training and has provided all the CPR and first aid training for the EOCF staff for the year. So it's the first time I'd ever been to this event. It was really, really nice, and it was absolutely very humbling to be honored. And last month I have The Deepest Well, for who would like to listen to this book by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. It's about ACEs. She's one of the leading people. If anybody would like to borrow this, I have this available free for borrowing. And then I'm going to send to Lydia, or I'll send it out to all of you, Mary Sisson, who's a local journalist, freelance journalist, and also owns Kazoo's Toy Store, wrote an article in this week's BBJ on early learning. And I want everybody to read it because it's exactly how important that early learning is. So I'll send that link to everybody for that. I'll send it to Lydia to send out to everybody. It's a nice article, and it really targets businesses, why early learning is important to the business community. It's not just us in health, it's our whole community. So that's all.
Thank you. All right. So I do not believe that we have 2/3. That is correct.
Correct.
The quorum discussion continues. So we were going to have a motion to amend our bylaws, but to amend our bylaws, we need to have 2/3 of members here. So what we will do is send out an email that we will report back to Lydia. You'll maybe send that, and then everybody will need to reply yay or nay. Or
we can reply here, I don't know.
And then just do the two follow-up.
Yeah. Is that okay?
So we can
vote here, and then...
So we'll vote. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So maybe, okay. As long as that's okay.
And this, if we pass this, it'll make it easier, right?
Exactly. Well, the bylaws, any change in our bylaws, I think, will continue to be 2/3. But we don't make a lot of changes in the bylaws anyways, but in general, any other voting will be a lot easier. We won't have to count heads, but today we did have to. Well, luckily Remy saw that. So I don't know if I need to read this, but the presence of a majority of the members of the Congress shall constitute a quorum. So basically saying the majority is going to be the quorum. A vote of the majority of the members of the council present at any meeting at which a quorum is presented shall be the act of the council. If a quorum of the members is not present at a meeting, a vote by email shall be considered on the approval of the executive committee. So, is there a motion to approve?
I have questions.
Yes.
I would like to see the bylaws before I vote on anything. And secondly, I've sat on many boards. Are you defining what your quorum is? Because you should have like a definition. If you say 2/3, I've never been on a board where two people could show up and that's a quorum. You have to define the quorum, and then that amount of people have to participate to be able to move things forward. So like a health board that I sit on, the Thompson East Tribe, there's 9 board members. You have to have 5 show up to make any sort of decisions.
That's what this is saying. The presence of a majority of the members of the council, and so we have generally 20 members of the council at this time. So that's what the majority of the members of the council shall.
Is that defined in the bylaws?
Yeah, the number 21, or the members of the council.
Correct, and I think with the orientation meeting, that you'll get all of that information. So, yeah.
But it'll still be two-thirds for changing in the bylaws.
Two-thirds.
But like the meeting minutes and things like that, that it'll be the majority instead of the two-thirds, which we've had to live with.
Correct. So this is for kind of approval of minutes and other things. If we're going to amend the bylaws, it has to be two-thirds of the members of the council, which are the 20... Two-thirds of the 20 members that are itemized in our bylaws.
But we're not changing that, so that's in a different part of the bylaws.
Correct. That is in the bylaws that, you know, Cassie will get, and so I would say maybe just abstain since you don't have the background yet to make it. I think that's totally... That would be very appropriate. Any more? Is there a motion? We can have a discussion.
I move we approve the motion to amend the bylaws.
Second.
Okay. Is there any more discussion on that? I know we did kind of go back and forth, but it's clear. I think it's clear for everybody understands kind of what that means. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And then one abstained? Okay. So it's not necessarily moved. It's in motion. Not moving. And maybe you can just let the council know when it's approved, or we can put that in the minutes. Because we will not have a meeting in June next month, as we normally take a break for June. So don't show up. No food will be served. And then we're proposing November 27th to cover both November and December, which is generally what we do. When is Thanksgiving? Do you know?
20.
Okay, so it would be the week after Thanksgiving.
Right.
Okay, that seems pretty reasonable.
The reason why we didn't do it December 4th is I think there's budget.
That's stuff. Yeah, that's the budget.
Okay, and then I think Roxanne's going to discuss this a little bit. Councillor Bolt has requested a little bit more interaction with us, which I think is great.
The council is very interested in having a joint meeting, but Councillor Bolt had requested that a member or two of FAC come and present at the July Board of Health meeting. And basically what we were thinking, he just wants an update. You know, what is it that we've been talking about, those sorts of things. And so we had suggested that NFP, ACEs, maybe potential fees, all of those things would be good things to probably have a discussion on. And if anybody is interested in appearing before the Board of Health on July 25th, anybody here interested, you can contact Lady and you can let us know now. We can also send out something.
Is it 9 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, 9 o'clock in the morning. And it's at the PSC, the Public Service Center on Franklin, at 9 o'clock in the morning. That's the only challenge. It's kind of not convenient for a lot of folks. So that's been the biggest challenge. But if anybody's willing to take a look at it, I can contact you and give you a little bit more information, or you can think about it, let Lydia know. We'll also send that out via email as well to the rest of the board members.
Yes. In addition to whoever might be speaking as part of the agreed upon, presence there, will other members of the council be also invited here just as a sort of show of solidarity or something?
Absolutely. So there's, I guess, a couple of parts to this. So anybody is welcome to be there. We're hoping that one or two folks would be willing to actually present to the Board of Health, but yes, everyone is welcome to join. The other thing is that the only challenge is at 9 o'clock on the middle of the week. It's kind of difficult for people to get there. The other thing that the council would like is a joint meeting. We did a joint meeting before here, which was fun. And now that we're not having to televise it, it's not going to be such a big deal to try to arrange that. But they're still interested in having a joint meeting as well. So we will be planning that sometime in the fall, or we'll be having a joint meeting with the Board of Health. Likely what it's going to be, it will be, I think last time we did the FAC meeting and then we went into Board of Health, is that correct? Is that what we did last time, or was it vice versa?
I have to look that up.
Pretty sure we had the FAC meeting first.
FAC meeting first, and then we just went right into Board of Health after that.
I thought so.
We may want to do it in the fall and then, you know, for the elections, do something with the new council in the spring.
Well, I don't think the joint meeting needs to be, at least historically, it didn't need to be Board of Health and Facts separate. I don't know why we would have done that, but in the past, it's just been a regular fact meeting with Board of Health here.
I think that's what we did. I don't think there, yeah.
Right, and we didn't supplant the board. We still had a Board of Health meeting. Was that they came here for that?
They joined us at our meeting.
Yeah, Janice is right.
And then I think the topic last time was ACEs, wasn't it? But that's another thing we might want to think about is what issue or what issue that you're working on or you're thinking about that you would want the Board of Health to be thinking about or cognitive of.
And thinking about it, that they're going to be in the midst, if it's in the fall, if it's not the November 27th meeting, if it's the October meeting, they'll be in the midst of elections. So something we might want to think about it. Well, you guys may want to think about what you want to do before or after, back meeting before or after the election.
Well, the election's in November.
Yeah.
I don't think we could do it after.
Okay. And we do it before. I mean, we do it before, and then there will be a new council. And then we may want to think of something, you know, in the spring.
You know, the council, going back in time, you know, the Growing Healthier report, I just mentioned that to Roxanne, was something that we were charged by the commissioners at that time to develop, and it would be important for us. And so maybe before we talked, met with the council in the spring, we could get an update ourselves and talk about the what's going on in the, with the implementation of the Growing Healthier report.
What about foundational public health? Is that an opportunity to bring that to them?
That's a good idea because for the next legislative session is a regular legislative session, and by that point we will have, that's a really good point because, you know, we're doing the foundational public health services assessment. That data have been collected and we're going to be compiling the cost and the gaps in terms of FPHS. And it's going to be part of our, across the state, it's going to be part of the main legislative ask for next session. That's our big funding ask. So that might be a really good, the FPHS thing may be really important. It's a good thing to think about.
So is anyone interested in thinking about volunteering?
What was the date again?
July 25th.
I can't. I don't know if I want to speak, but I don't know if I want to do a presentation, but I'll support.
You're talking about tsunami.
Well, that would be more fun. But
I
would be happy to go and support how and be whatever you guys need me to do. If you need me to speak, I can go.
Adrian is available.
I am available, but I don't want
somebody
else. It makes me very nervous.
What's that?
Make me very nervous.
Well, I mean, we'll work on reaching out to some of you and talking about if you, I mean, if you don't want to do that, if you just want to go and be there, that would be fine too.
We'll have talk.
I can be there.
We'll talk
about it later.
I mean, yeah. I don't have to
talk about it later, but
we'll make it.
I'm available and Wednesdays are fine.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like it would be necessary to. Strategy about this, and that we come prepared, that we agree about what the talking points are, and so that anybody could be called.
Are you volunteering?
Yes, Marla wants to come with me. Marla will be my voice, and I will be the supporter.
Not saying that, I'm just saying I would like to be here. I'm pretty new to this group, and there are a lot of others that are seasoned professionals here. But I do would like it if we can feel that we're. In concert around what we're going to
do. Do you guys want to have, I'm putting you on this, but I have a little small group to work with us on what you might want to
That might be good.
Do? That way if we work on it ahead of time, you might feel a bit more comfortable with that.
I think that's a good idea.
Roxanne, is that?
Yeah, that's fine. So, three people that I've heard so far, Marla, Adrian, Joan.
I'll be back up because I've done a lot of this.
Is there anybody else that might be interested in joining this work group? And Marissa, I'll bring you in as well to help with this.
I'm going to be on vacation.
Paul.
I'm going to be on vacation.
You
can call in. Take the snorkel out of my mouth.
Take the snorkel out.
And what I'll do, we'll also send out to the rest of the group, we'll pull them as well. We'll pull together this group, and then we'll have this, the strategy all built, the messaging, all of that stuff before the July.
Yeah, and I think we can bring it to the next time meeting.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, since we're not having a meeting in June, it'll be nice. We can have a small group in June and not feel like we're public health every day.
Yep, that's a good idea. Yeah, so we'll bring it to the faculty second meeting.
Well, we have a meeting in July.
Yeah. We'll have a meeting right before.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Thank you, everybody. And then, do you want me to talk about the calendar real quick?
Sure.
Okay. So one of the things that we've been working with the executive team on is putting together the whole planning calendar for FEC. One of the things that we've been really struggling with is from past years, there were really a lot of things that FEC actually sort of was really able to dig into. You mentioned the Brown Health Report, that's a great example. The challenge we've had is that there haven't been those types of things for FEC necessarily to work on. There's been a lot of budgeting issues and those sorts of things, but there hasn't been a lot of those sort of project types of things. And so what we wanted to do, there's been a lot of suggestions of things that people are interested in learning more about and potentially exploring. And what we've been working with the FEC executive team to do is actually flesh out a calendar so that we can put on some topics, but we can also bring in the perspective of what is of the public health role, and then also what is the role of FEC as the advisory to the Board of Health? What is the role for FEC, and what do we want to do with some of these topics that we're going to be discussing? And Paula, you brought up the Ben, I don't know if you want to jump in right now, but you brought up potentially having some more work around gun violence.
Gun violence and gun control.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that came up right after the Florida shootings, high school, there was one of the people with the, I think it was either the hospitals or with the CDC, that mentioned that this is a public health issue. Murder of so many kids through automatic weapons has become a public health issue. I thought it might be something that we could bring up and discuss our positioning. I didn't bring it with me, but Joan gave me a copy of the position of the nurses are in as far as what their thoughts are, and I thought it would be something that we could discuss and perhaps bring it up to the city councilor. And Roxanne gave me kind of a itinerary of what was the thoughts here as far as that, and that's great. I think it's super. So I think that's something that was an issue that we could bring up. Because I want to go further than, I know that across the river here in Oregon, the legislature's already got some legislation that they're bringing up as far as gun control. And that's the thing. There's a lot of different thoughts on this, and there's going to be a lot of pluses and minuses, people thinking their thoughts about what needs to be done. But I think that there definitely needs to be common sense gun control legislation. And that's basically where I am on that. But I think as far as a public health issue, I think it's something that we need to go over with maybe with Sandy or with someone with the school system. And of course with Chief Richardson as far as what the police are doing, what the sheriff's department is doing, what things that they are doing in order to make part. I thought about, I was so gung-ho that I was already to go to Washington already on this thing, but I thought, let's go step at a time. We'll go one step at a time. The interesting thing about this is right after this happened, there was a governor's conference in Washington, and there were all the governors in the room, and of course President Trump, and our governor Governor Inslee stood up in front of all the governors, and this was when they wanted they were talking about having the teachers arm themselves. And Governor Inslee said, you know, we don't want, in Washington, we don't want the teachers to arm themselves. We want protection, but we don't want the teachers to arm themselves. And I think Trump said something, and our governor said, I think that if you did a lot less tweeting and a little bit more of listening to what the public has to say, you know, you might do better. I hit him on the back, you know. So, you know, but I think that's a subject that we could discuss. I think that was something we could do, and I think, again, your outline was great.
So what we're doing, one of the other things that was brought up with a previous presentation when we were talking a little bit about school safety and the youth suicide was the child death review. And we have had an opportunity to work with some of our regional partners, and there is an opportunity for us to develop a child death review and really get some access to some great data and some comparative data. So initially, child death reviews, and Ellen, you can talk a little bit more about this, but they were really more around, you know, taking a look at, is there anything about this child death that there's some foul play involved in, or there's some prosecution, you know, that should happen. So they were really more focused around law enforcement types of things. Well, this is really more focused around the data, around really looking at what types of situations or what are the causes of child death across the region. So we have an opportunity to really get some very rich data. So that's what we're doing right now. Our Healthy Communities team, David Hudson and his group, are involved, and some of our epidemiologists are involved in that right now. So we'll be able to bring back some data around that so that you all will have a chance to take a look at that. The other thing that came up was, again, around some school safety. So we'll be working with ESD 112 and Prevent Coalition. I'm hoping to get them on at our next or July meeting, but I don't know if they'll be available, to talk about what they're doing for school safety and that sort of a thing. And then also Bob Richardson with the School Resource Officer. So we're in the process of doing all of that. The calendar that we're filling out will have those things on it, so we'll be able to share with you. And then, you know, look at ideas that you have, but also look at it, like I said, in terms of what is the purview of FAC, and your role is to advise the Board of Health. So what kinds of information do you need to do that, and what can public, you know, the public health, also what kind of capacity do we have in public health to actually support that? So that's another issue. There might be some things that are very labor intensive that we may not be able to do, but certainly collecting the data and being able to bring back data to you so that you can make some decisions is certainly something that we'll be able to do. So those are all the things I think that
Dylan is. We'll keep posted on, yeah, you know, on what DOH is up to, uh-huh, also, because I haven't seen, yeah, but I mean, I haven't seen what State Department of Health has put out yet on this, right, but we'll keep you posted. I know the health officers are talking about, right, it.
You know, the interesting thing about it, and the thing that we don't have our ear to the ground on this, is this is happening all the time. Kids are getting shot at schools, but it's just not a mass shooting. You know, there was this one in north of L.A. Last week, you know. Shortly thereafter in Florida, there was a kid who was, I think he was 17 years old. He brought a gun to school and shot a kid. He got the gun through mail order. I mean,
that's why this child fatality, yeah, review is going to be, because actually a lot of kids they're shot at home.
Yeah.
So, and young people, suicide is the number two cause of death. Mm-hmm. And most of that is committed with, most of them committed with handguns. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of information that we need to compile and talk about this, and I think that's what our team is going to be working on, and probably inform the Prevent Coalition as well, because I think we need to work with our, mm-hmm, with our partners on this as well.
You know, two other things that
our, you know, the second State of the Children report will be coming out, looking at the children in our community, their readiness for kindergarten, looking at all those domains. We need to be aware of that. That's something that's been on our agenda. And then the other one is, we just got the report from the Point in Time homeless count, you know, and the it's up, you know, in terms of families, et cetera. And so they actually have a presentation, perhaps from the Council for the Homeless, on what's going on with the issues with people who are homeless in our community and what are some of the strategies that are being developed there. So I think those are topics that are something we've talked about before and that we can have updates on the news, the updated State of the Children report, and then the homeless situation, Point in Time, the data was just released.
Well, I know that there's a lot to be said about from the mental aspect. I know that this all follows the suit from the mental aspect, you know, making sure that the kids in school, even the, you know, things like that, that there's people can recognize, you know, when they're a little, when there's a problem, when they have a problem, and recognize that. And there needs to be, you know, communication between the health department, the schools, and, you know, there has to be, I mean, when I say communication, there has to be, you know, a file, you know, things that, when there's a problem, when there's an issue. But again, these are things that we can discuss and see what our thoughts are and how we're going to regulate these things.
Okay. Are there any other council member updates?
I have something I wanted to share. It came to me in the mail from Skagit County because we have a couple of little rentals in that county. And so this is going on in Washington. I'm going to send it to, give it to Lydia and ask her to make a copy or copies. And then so I kind of like to hang on to this and share it with others. But basically, it just came in like with a utility bill. And it's just a little pamphlet, but it's very, it's got a lot of information. It's about opioid addict problem that we're having in our country right now. Talks about locking up medications, monitoring meds, take back opportunities, and they're really expanding them in Skagit County, just like here, and informing the public about that. It's got a little thing about the Be a Good Samaritan, call 911, and information about the Good Samaritan law, that if a person is with someone, two people are together using drugs, and one becomes limp and appears to be suffering from an overdose, that the other person might be afraid to call for help because they too have drugs in their possession, and this is saying it's okay, you know, you're not going to be arrested for that, call 911 and save a life. It's got really good little graphics about symptoms of overdose, and it was just so much information in such a little pamphlet. I thought it would be something that I wanted to share with this group, and Roxanne shared with me that there's some activity going on here that might produce something similar.
So the Prevent Coalitions are working on, there's an ESD 112, they have a opioid grant, and they're working on, it's really focused on youth, but they're working on all kinds of different opportunities for advertising and for getting the word out. And so they're doing something similar, although I don't know that they're partnering. I think it's a great idea to partner and have that just come into your utility bill. That's a wonderful idea. The other thing is the Southwest ECH Opioid Work Group. This is something certainly we can share with them as well.
Great.
So the Harm Reduction Center gives this information out, along with naloxone, which is an antidote. So, and we're trying to do whatever we can and get more naloxone out.
To me, what was the most interesting was the method of distribution to get it in the utility bill, which everybody uses utilities in Skagit County gets. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty broad reach. Mm-hmm. So Lydia, I'm going to give you this to copy.
Perfect.
Yeah. Or you can give me a copy and keep the original, whatever you want to do.
Okay, that all works.
I have one last announcement, and I'll forward it to Lydia. Clark County is in the process of working on the Homeless Action Plan. It's going to be seeking input from people in the community about what our community can do to address the homeless situation in our community.
There are going to be sessions. They're an hour and a half session for input from the public on May 16th, 24th, 29th, 31st, June 5th, and June 11th. Four in Vancouver, one in Battleground, and one in Camas. So I'll send that information to Lydia to get it. No pre-registration. It's just something you go to, and it'll be a facilitated process to have, to update the Clark County's homeless action plan.
Are they evening sessions, or do you know what happens?
Yeah, they're a
variety of times.
Okay.
Speaking of communication, I just don't want to digress, but when you brought up that about the Romaine, I belong to the Public Technical Food Safety Committee also, and we were discussing this with that group. And one of the things that we brought up was, whenever something like this happens, how can we get the information out to the stores and to the restaurants? But what was interesting was I went around to several different restaurants where managers I know and everything, like the Alexandria and everything like that, they already do, because their company had already, corporate office had already issued that out. But I'm thinking about the small mom and pop operations to let how to communicate with them. So just, we're working on that.
If you solve that here, whatever you learn would be useful all over the U.S.
Yes.
All right. We're earlier than normal. That's good.
We can talk some more about TV.
Yeah, you don't want to ask, but you may.
So don't forget, no meeting in June. I mean, if you show up, we'll be happy to get you a glass of water or something.
Okay, motion to adjourn? We don't have to do a motion to adjourn? So, okay, so all in favor of adjourning? Do we do that? Or we can say adjourn? Okay. Oh, let's do the voting to adjourn.